base of sports organisations from Olympic Agenda 2020 and the transformation of the Commonwealth Games, we find out how smart rights holders and federations are changing for the better. So I'll just start by quickly introducing the panel, beginning with Louise Martin. Louise, you're behind the screen there. Louise Martin, CBE, President of the Commonwealth Games Federation and Chair of Sports Scotland. Sarah Lewis, who is Secretary General of the International Ski Federation and also of the Association of International Olympic Winter Sports Federations. And that is, as you may know, the world's most unpronounceable acronym. We also have Brian Cookson, President of the UCI, the International Cycling Federation. And finally, Janesh Kocijancic, Vice President of the European Olympic Committees and Honorary President of the Slovenian Olympic Committee. And just before we start, just to give a little bit of context perhaps, in his speech at the opening of the IOC session in Monaco on 7th of December last year, I was there, I heard it, so already that was just a month short of a year ago, Thomas Bach, the IOC president, said, "We need to change because sport today is too important in society to ignore the rest of society. We are not living on an island, we are living in the middle of a modern, diverse, digital society. If we want to continue to put Olympic sport at the service of society, which is part of our Olympic principles, we must engage with this society. We must be in a respectful dialogue with this society." As many of you will know, from an IOC president, that was somewhat radical. This is an organization that has sometimes seemed a little averse to change in the past, and that has certainly sometimes seemed unwilling to engage with society. So under Bach, sport and politics, it seems, do mix. I'll just come and take my place now. So I wanted to start with a general question on Agenda 2020. Most of you in this room will be aware of what Agenda 2020 is. It's a radical reform program for the IOC and for the Olympic Games. And I wanted to put a general question perhaps to each of the panelists, which is, what does Agenda 2020 mean to you? Why is it important? How will it change? And is it changing your event and sport? And were there any changes that you would like to see that were not included in Agenda 2020? And perhaps I can start at the far end with Janesh, if I may. I have a more specific question for you, Louise.
Thank you for the floor. First, now we are on an island, but it doesn't change a lot. You know, the problem is universal. The society is changing, the world is changing, and international sport should change as well. And from my point of view, Agenda 2020 is a try how to adapt the international sport to modern need. President Dr. Thomas Bach was even more radical in Monte Carlo. He said, if we will not accept the change, then the change will take us. And it would be correct like that. Of course, if you try to change a very complex phenomenon like the international sport is, you have to keep in mind that change is not something what you make once. Change should be permanent and should be even deeper than in this 2020 agenda. 20 agenda is a good try, but we should go further.
What do you mean by that, by going further?
That means, of course, that we should analyze the developments in the world. I think that nowadays sport is in a big crisis. We deal with the problems like doping, like corruption, like inaccountability, and we should deal with all those problems properly. I think that we are in a pressing need for an international universal code of ethics. We should define precisely the responsibility of those who in principle form modern sports that are volunteers, grassroots sport, and on the other side, the duties and obligations of the professionals. and we should make a very good and valid system how to control the developments which are a consequence of liberal capitalism, where a youngster of 25 can sign a contract for 100 million and where all of the sudden all around him, not only the coaches and the managers, try to think that they should get a part of it.
And for the European Olympic Committees, were the parts of Agenda 2020 that resonate especially for you? For example, does it make it more likely that European cities might win the right to host the Olympics in the future?
Well, first, every problem is a problem by itself. Olympic committees of Europe are a very essential part of international Olympic movement. One quarter of it, Olympic committees and Olympic movements in Europe make in Summer Olympics 48% of medals in London or in Beijing, both times the same percentage, or 78% in Winter Olympics. So they are very important for the international Olympic movement. And we would like to go further in democratization of international Olympic movement. Sooner or later we should come to a discussion what to do with the so-called principle that IOC is a self-electing body, and maybe come to the principles which are prevalent in other international organizations where you have representations of the countries or of the national Olympic committees, as we have nowadays in ANOC. I think that Europe would like to have more transparent policy in international sport, of course taking in account that nobody can project his ideas completely and directly to the other countries. We should be able to listen to everybody.
Thanks, Janusz. Sarah, what does Agenda 2020 mean to you and to the FIS?
On two different levels, there are the issues connected, of course, with our role as part of the Olympic Winter Games, which is a very, very important one, and the effect of Olympic Agenda 2020 on the execution of the Games, the bidding process for the Games, and everything surrounding the Games. But also, they have been a pretty important stimulus, actually, for the processes within our own federation. And in fact, in addition to his other titles, Janusz Kocianczyk is the vice president of the International Ski Federation, and we've been addressing a number of these issues also within our organization, and he has the task now to work on our ethical code for good governance within the federation. So we've taken a lot of the important elements presented in Olympic Agenda 2020 and try to expand on them. I think, as he said, it's a start, and they are not, let's say, the new commandments, but they are a very important platform for the federations to have an opportunity to look at itself, to talk really in detail about the complexities that are facing us and address them and try to address them. Not saying that all problems are going to be resolved by Olympic Agenda 2020, but first of all, you have to confront them. You have to actually address what they are. Are we dealing with them? Are we handling them in the best way? Are there new ways of doing it? And yeah, we have to adapt. It's about also young people, about the future of our sport, the sustainability of what we're doing. And it is a very different situation within with the Olympic Games themselves, or the Olympic Winter Games in our case, that take place every 4 years, and then an international federation activities. Brian, we probably are talking about a similar number of events in our federations. We have 7,000 competitions that are taking place every year. And of course, that's pretty different to one major event every 4 years in terms of also the different levels going down from youth through regional, national, continental, international, world stage, and how the different demands and the different challenges are then really addressed.
You mentioned that some of the elements you're trying to take even further than in Agenda 2020. Can you give me an example of that?
Further. I mean, I think that Olympic Agenda 2020 itself actually was the 20 plus 20 elements, but all of the sub-points to it are very, very considerable. Taking the point of governance, there is an overall, let's say, statement which is given, but then it's really going through into the details. So whether it's taking further or just using it how it was intended, which is to provide you a platform to be able to then go into the detail. And that's how we see it in any case. And I think that's it's been an important stimulus. And this is something that the colleagues have also expressed. Sustainability is a very important one, and there I would say yes. That's a point that we've specifically addressed. We are in a different world within international federations compared to the Games, because generally the major events where there's the most investment which is made in terms of infrastructure, in terms of human resources and so on, are done for organisers who are repeated organisers, who are part of the system, who are there since many years and probably will be there for many years into the future. The Olympic Games and major events like the Commonwealth Games have different goals, and generally those goals are also very much affected on the social development within the city and the region, which they should be, quite rightly. And therefore, the specific sports element play a rather a different role. So this is something that we're working in, and not only within our activities, but in the context of the Games as well.
Perhaps we can come back to sustainability. I think there are certainly some concerns about snowmaking machines, for example, around the world and the use of snowmaking machines, but perhaps we'll return to that a little bit later. Brian, how about you and Agenda 2020? What's your views?
Is that on? Yeah, okay. Let's be clear, everyone's in favour of change, everyone's in favour of adopting new technology, innovation and so on. You would be a fool not to in a world that is changing very, very quickly. The practicalities of Agenda 2020 have hit us quite hard as a sport. We've been asked to accept some pretty radical changes in Tokyo, for instance, perhaps more radical than anybody else, any other sport, arguably. And that includes looking at moving our venues quite some distance from Tokyo, and that's a work in progress. And I think, you know, we're quite close to a solution on that. But I think, if anything, perhaps Agenda 2020, maybe I could say it didn't go far enough. I think we've got to keep adopting change. As has been said previously, change isn't something that you do once and then forget about it. You have to keep adapting, keep evolving. If you don't, like the dinosaurs, you become extinct, and we can't afford to do that. And I just wanted to pick up one thing that was said in the last session about young people and so on. Let's not forget, we've all got a young person inside us. Yesterday I was out on my bike, I did 3 hours. I had a Garmin on my handlebars, I had a smartphone with Strava in the back of my pocket. I downloaded all the data onto Facebook and tweeted about it and so on. So, you know, innovation and adoption of technology isn't just restricted to young people, if I may put in a plea on behalf of us grey-haired men in suits. Yeah, some of us are down with the kids, man.
I think one or two of the ladies in the audience may be a bit alarmed to hear they have a young person inside them, but anyway. Brian, you mentioned that at Tokyo 2020 you're in negotiations to move your events to a more decent venue. What are your concerns, and do they revolve around that sort of old ideal that an Olympic Games should be centered on the Olympic Village, at which all of the athletes stay to experience that amazing atmosphere that everyone talks about?
Yeah, that is part of it. And from our point of view as a sport, we want to make sure that we're at the heart of things, that we give the best possible experience for our athletes, and that we are accessible to the public, to the media, and so on. So these are serious concerns. But I do think also it turns around back into the impact that a major games, a major sports event has on the host city. You know, Manchester, I remember very well, British Cycling, where I was president for 17 years. We were based in Manchester. I saw, you know, I live near Manchester, so I saw the transformational effect that it had on the city and on the people of the city. And I think major games, major championships, those kind of things, if you get them right, the impact of them, as others have said this morning already, is huge. The transformational effect, the self-confidence that it brings back to a host city, that's something that we shouldn't throw away lightly. This is something that the Olympic Games, Commonwealth Games, World Championships and so on, that brings to a city, that sense of self-belief. Definitely in the case of Manchester, and I'm sure it's true here in Glasgow as well, the Commonwealth Games, for instance, was something that really helped the city believe in itself again.
Thanks, Brian. Louise, I know that the general question is perhaps some of it not relevant to you, so I had a slightly more specific question which relates to Glasgow's hosting of the Commonwealth Games last year, and whether that's the limit of its ambition in terms of multi-sports events. As chair of Sports Scotland, I wonder if Agenda 2020's cost-cutting measures have made the Olympics a more attractive proposition for perhaps we could call them medium-sized cities like Glasgow.
In my heart, I would love to say yes, we could do it. In my head, we couldn't do it. We're not big enough. What we had at last year in 2014, that was absolutely superb. We were at our maximum 4,500 athletes living in the village. The work that was done within Glasgow Life, and the partners that we were working with, that's how we were able to do such a fantastic Games. And that legacy does live on. However, going back to the Olympics, we were part of the London Olympics because we hosted. We hosted football up here. So there's nothing to stop the medium cities being able to host anywhere, if it's possible, as long as it's within the IOC and the host city that has been given the Games. I mean, in Scotland alone, we have so many wonderful venues, right from Aberdeen Sports Village coming down to Dundee to the Olympia and the new gymnastics centre there down into Glasgow, where we've got so many fantastic venues now that the biggest problem now is people who want to go in and use them have got to book about a month in advance because they are so well used, and that's the legacy itself from the Games. And so, of course, you build your own problems when you've got such good venues. So, yes, it would be, as long as we are part of a larger setup, we could do it. We in Glasgow, and I'm quite sure Bridget and Ian would turn around and say exactly the same thing, heart and heart, we'd love to do it, but head, we just couldn't possibly do it. We're just not big enough to do it.
Is that then a failure of Agenda 2020? Surely Agenda 2020, a lot of what it's trying to do is expand the range of cities that could host the Olympic Games. And you would think if Glasgow can't, you know, that there's an awful lot of cities that can't.
If we were able to host the Games throughout Scotland and put them each different sport into the different venues that we have, I think we could look at it, but cost-wise, I don't think the Scottish Government would be able to do it. But we also have to remember that Scotland are not members of the Olympic Games. It's Great Britain that's members of the Olympic Games. No matter how much we would like to be, we are under the UK Government and the GB setup. So it's a whole different ballgame for us.
You raise an interesting point there. I think there were some people who felt, and some people probably who still feel, that it should be a country that bids to host the Olympics, not a city, because, as you say, for many cities it's just out of their grasp. Why not? Why not open bidding for the Olympics to a country?
I would have no problems with that. I mean, what we do in the Commonwealth Games Federation, it actually goes to, it's the Commonwealth Games Association that has to bid for it. But before they can bid for it, they have to have the city chosen. They have to go through a process to choose the city. But also, they have to have the backing of the government to be able to underwrite the whole thing. And if it's not underwritten by the government, we will not accept that bid. It has to be underwritten. Because who in an OC would take on a major thing if it's not underwritten by somebody else, because it's just not viable? And can I just say that when we went through the bid, right from when we started in 2002 and when we actually launched 2004, we won in 2007, we had a change of government from Labour to SNP, and I guarantee nobody in the Commonwealth knew that we had a change of government. The government, whichever government it was, working with the city, working with the Games Association, that partnership was so tight. Okay, behind closed doors, many times we had the big fights, but when we came outside, we all sang from the same hymn sheet, and that is what is so important. And this partnership is still there. We're all still working together. And that's why that Bridget knows she can come to Sport Scotland and say, well, we need some help with this, or we need some secondees moving into other things, or the government can come and say, well, we need to do A, B, and C. We're still able to do that, and to me, that is one of the secrets of success about the whole thing, is this partnership working.
Excellent. Thanks, Louise. Sarah, if I could come back to you, and just to talk a little bit more about the 2022 Winter Olympic bid process, which I think raised serious fears that we might be running out of potential Winter Olympic host cities. How do you view Agenda 2020 strategy for encouraging more bidders? Do you think it will work? I'm particularly thinking about the Winter Olympics.
What we've already seen from 2024 is that that's already had a first very positive stimulus. There have been five excellent candidates for the Summer Games, and that's a higher number than there was for the 2020 Games, for the Summer Games. So the first signs are very positive, but it's all very well to say that, and then to say, well, and automatically this is going to happen for the Winter Games. It isn't. And we're all being proactive. The IOC is being proactive. And we have actually a task force that are gathering this upcoming week with the whole series of meetings in Lausanne to address the roadmap to 2026, actually. Mm-hmm. There's been quite a lot of interest out there already from various cities. I think, Yannis, you can also confirm from several of our representatives in the FIS Council from different nations, where there are discussions going on in their countries, serious discussions. Sweden, for example, a couple of others who don't wish to be named. Norway again, Switzerland, plus a couple more. So there are discussions going on, and not just at a federation level, at a political level, which is important. But now we're going to come together, all of the Winter IFs, together with the IOC, address what are the issues, actually. There is very much a perception out there concerning the size of the investment, everything that has to be created. Is it only for the Games? What actually are the legacies that are being presented? There's still the information, the communication about everything that happened around and in Sochi to prepare for the Games, what was Games, what is actually the legacy for the region. To give you an example, actually, they had a completely sold-out winter last season, the ski area, and outstanding figures in terms of tourist visits. It was impossible actually to be able to get there during the peak parts of the season because the hotels were all busy. So that's, from a touristical point of view, a very positive legacy. So there are a lot of things behind that haven't been communicated in terms of the opportunities that are created by the Games, and that's work that we, and especially the IOC, are very intensively doing.
And maybe this would be the moment to address that sort of sustainability issue with the Winter Olympics and with winter sports more generally. I mean, there are concerns, I think, of the costs and the environmental implications of, for example, snowmaking machines. There's also the continuing concern over the incredible cost of building any new bobsleigh track. Obviously, bobsleigh isn't your sport, but I just wonder whether you feel that, and in those conversations with those cities that you're talking about, that they feel that some of those issues are being addressed by Agenda 2020?
Well, there's the opportunity for them to be addressed, and that's the most important thing. And yes, perhaps to give you some specifics, when it comes to snowmaking, we're not looking here about snowmaking investment to serve Olympic Games for 3 weeks. We're talking here about tourism. And I think we're in a country that also has a strong winter tourism in several excellent ski areas. And in fact, when I was competing, which is a very long time ago, actually living in Scotland, that was after my active career. Nevertheless, you know, the amount of days when it wasn't possible to be able to ski, not because only of the wind and the weather and the roads, but because of the snow situation, that has changed pretty significantly now with the investment in snowmaking. Now, the tourist motivation is the main reason, actually, for being able to develop and improve snowmaking. And thanks to technologies, there are now efficiencies in the use of energy, in the use of power, and water as well, that they're able to make snow at approximately four times the intensity for less than 50% of the power. So technology there has a big advancement and a big role to play in terms of what it can do, and then the tourist element too. So that's small defence of snowmaking. Other point is in terms of a very expensive facility like bobsleigh, which doesn't have a tourism legacy from a point of view of visitors, although there are certain tracks around the world that have an excellent program going on in the winter with taxi rides and so kind of Disneyland in the bobsleigh set up. Mm-hmm. And yes, they are very open-minded to be able to use sliding tracks that already exist around the world. Again, coming back to a point that I made before, one of the issues with the Games is that the motivation for a city, and now potentially also a country or a region, to be bidding for the Games is not connected to their particular affiliation to certain sports. And therefore, you're looking in a large number of cases that new facilities are being built. So what has to be built permanently? What can be done temporarily? Sliding are looking at a temporary opportunity as well, so that they've got a facility that can be used, dismantled, or let's say adjusted, so that it has another effect afterwards. That and Agenda 2020 has stimulated those discussions, which is important.
Yes, that's interesting. I was talking to a professor at Lausanne University who is involved in developing an artificial ice surface, which would be completely demountable and transportable. The IOC, I think, is not ready to accept that yet, but perhaps Agenda 2020 will make it more open-minded. Brian, just turning to you, one of the things that Agenda 2020 talks about and that has had perhaps the most exposure is the move from a sports-based program to an event-based one, and the opportunities that will throw up to refresh the Olympic program. Do you welcome that? And do you think one of the sports that is being proposed for addition to the program for the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo is skateboarding? And I know that UCI has had talks over skateboarding in the past. Are you involved any more in that?
There's a short answer to that, and it's no.
Okay, but what about the move to an event-based program? Does that help you as a sport? Because you've lost some disciplines in recent years, haven't you?
We have lost some disciplines in recent years, and that's very disappointing. I'm determined that we don't lose any other disciplines or events in our program. But at the same time, I do want to embrace innovation. You know, we brought BMX in after 2004. We brought that in 2008. That's fine. We had to lose some track events to give us a 50-50 gender balance, which was, you know, the right thing to do, to have the gender balance. But I think it was regrettable that we lost some classic track events, for instance, some velodrome events. And, you know, I've still got some of my 185 national federations who want me to push back on that. And, you know, we will do our best to balance that against the needs of innovation and so on. So, yeah, if 2020 gives us the freedom to move around our events, to think about what events we have in our program, then that's got to be a good thing. But can I also just say that, to pick up on what Sarah was saying in the previous question as well, you know, if a host city just thinks about the event in terms of the number of days that event is on, and you have to build those facilities, and they cost many millions of pounds, dollars, euros, whatever, then that's a big mistake. You know, if I use the example of a velodrome, to build a velodrome, the capital cost of that is quite substantial. Obviously, if it's an indoor one, even more so. And, you know, I've got a number of velodromes around the world now that people are saying to me, well, they're not used and so on. Well, I say, okay, well, come and look at Manchester. Come and look at London. Come and look at the Sir Chris Hoy Velodrome here in Glasgow. You can't just invest in the capital infrastructure. You have to invest in the people that make things work as well. And that's your legacy. That's the legacy of a major games and a major championships that we should all be aiming for. And I think that absolutely fits with Agenda 2020 as well.
Excellent. Thanks, Brian. Janesh, I know you were for many years president of the Slovenian Olympic Committee, and you are still honorary president. I just wonder whether, for a smaller country with smaller cities perhaps such as yours, what opportunities Agenda 2020 offers, whether there are, perhaps it's the Youth Olympics, perhaps the Winter Olympics, I don't know.
Well, that's certainly a problem. You know, my country is highly successful regarding sport results. We took 8 medals in Sochi, for instance, during the Winter Olympics. That is one per every 250,000 inhabitants. It's the best result ever. And similar it was in London, in Beijing, in Vancouver. But we are unable to organize summer or Winter Olympics because they are too costly. And it would be a huge question. There were several initiatives, but we turned them down. We didn't accept them. It would be a huge question what to do with the facilities after the Olympics. I know that in many countries the Olympic infrastructure after the Games is a ghost city. It's very difficult even in a huge city like Beijing, with nearly 20 million inhabitants, to fill up every week or every second day the bird's nest. And to build something like that in a small country is a big question, and our social responsibility or sense for social responsibility says us that we shouldn't compete in this. We could be part of larger initiatives. We were twice bidders in the so-called concept Olympic Games Without Borders, together with neighboring regions of Italy and Austria. We could organize European championships, some larger events in different sports. The biggest event we had was European Youth Festival, but we are unable to organize such large competitions like Summer or Winter Olympic Games. Maybe Youth Olympic Games, I would say Winter Olympic Games, but there has to be a deeper analysis made before.
So perhaps moving away from the Olympics then, What kind of events is Slovenia targeting, and are its cities targeting? Which cities are involved in bidding for and hosting international events?
It is very typical that all the countries would like to have the events in the sports in which they are strong. You know, we lately had the European Championships in basketball. We would like to have big events in judo, where we make medals. We will have the World Ski Flying Championships, where we are also strong, and so on. So my answer to such a question normally is that there is no country which would have the same sport structure than any other country in the world. We have different identity cards, and we follow different goals. Although at the end of the day, somebody might say they are all similar. They aren't. They aren't. And we have our own interest, and we are looking for the sports events which correspond to our own sport structure and our own sport needs.
Okay, thanks, Janesh. Louise, I know the CGF has its own Transformation 2022 program. I wonder if you could just give us a little introduction to that, what it's intended to achieve and how it differs from Agenda 2020. And in particular, I know you're changing or have changed your system for deciding which sports are on the program of the Commonwealth Games. Could you explain how you approach that?
Yes, well, maybe David should be the one answering all of this. He and his team actually worked it before we came to the executive board, and then it was actually passed at our General Assembly in Auckland 2 months ago. Basically what it is, we've got it's building on our strategic plan from 2012, and it's got four main priorities, and that is having innovative and inspirational games, both the main games and the youth games, good governance throughout, and working on our marketing and commercial side of it, and then a very, very strong brand. And what we need to do from all of that is making sure that if we have innovative and inspirational games, we'll get lots of cities bidding. We want to have cities bidding for this, so we have to make sure that the product that we have will suit them. And also, if we want to try and make sure that our main games resonate with everybody within the Commonwealth, but also our youth games are really, really important. Now, they're not important as medal targets or anything like that. We're trying to ensure that we go back to our basics, where we started off with the games as being educational and a cultural experience for all the athletes from 14 to 18 throughout the Commonwealth. It's not to go there and win. Yes, they'll all want to win a medal, but to us it's more important that they get the educational experience of how their peers live and work and train. And having just come off the back of Samoa, which is so completely different from a lot of other countries, where some of them did not appreciate where they had to shower in cold water. But when you've got temperatures of 30, 35, 40, cold water to them is a great luxury. So it's just bringing everything back into perspective for that. But also, one of the other big things that we've never been allowed to do in the Commonwealth, which I could never understand it, we don't have major sponsors. We don't have sponsors. That's down to the organising committees to organise. So our comment now is, why do we put all that onus on an organising committee to raise the money to run the games, when their onus should be on ensuring that the games are run exactly as sports want them to be? Take all that pressure, or take most of the pressure off them. So we are now looking at seeing how we can get major sponsors or major groups coming on board to work with us to try and alleviate the problem for the organising committee. And ideally, in a great world, it would be good to have them on board for 2 or 3 cycles or something like that. So that process is just starting. And we've got to make sure that the brand we have is really, really strong. Mm-hmm. It is getting there, but it's not as strong as it should be. And then you asked me about the sports and the programme. As you all know, we always had core sports, 10 core sports. And you're absolutely right, Yannick, when you're talking about you put a host city or an organising committee going in for a bid. You choose the sports that you know that you're good at and you can win medals at, because that's where your money's going to come from. And we did. We blatantly did. We put judo back in the programme and we got our medals from that. Manchester, we won 10 and they were out for the next two cycles and they were back in again in Glasgow. So we won more medals that way. So that's how you work it. But it's not fair throughout the Commonwealth, because a lot of sports need to know and countries need to know that the sport is in the programme so they can actually plan for it and train the athletes for it to ensure that they can deliver at games time. So what we've done now is we've got 17 sports committed on the programme for 2018 and 2022, and then we've categorised the other sports into priority and recognised sports. So it's still causing one or two wee hiccups with some of them, but they would like to be in, and you can imagine, but we've got to give it a chance somewhere. And to us, putting all the sports in the programme, then the organising committee and those cities who are bidding for it know exactly where they stand.
Interesting. And you mentioned your bid process. Obviously, for 2022, you were left with just a single bidder, Durban. I mean, fortunately, a credible, highly credible bidder, but obviously that's not ideal. What can you do to encourage more cities to bid for the Commonwealth Games?
Well, actually, it worked out for us because, as you know, we did have two to start with, and I chaired the Evaluation Commission. So when we started off, we had Edmonton and Durban, and then by the time we actually started to do the actual evaluation process, Edmonton had pulled out, so we went into Durban. Now, how do you evaluate a city and a country that is, you know, you need them, you can't lose them? So therefore, we changed the whole process. And instead of evaluating, we worked in partnership with them. We took them through all the processes, and they took us through everything they were doing. Now, I must admit, on day one, oh boy, it was like either side of the table, no, you're out to judge us. We weren't out to judge them. What we were trying to do is find out exactly what they had, what they intended to do, and how we could help or give the experience to make it slightly better. And by the end of the week that we were in, it was chalk from cheese. It was fantastic. And my recommendation now would be, we work with bidding cities, as I think from what I'm hearing that the 2020 is doing, getting it down. But once you've chosen, forget, you know, you really sit down and just work with them all the way through. And what we're doing now is the evaluation team, some of the team will stay with Durban until we put a co-com in with 4 years to go.
Sarah, did you want to say something?
Yes, along those lines, actually, this is a cornerstone, really, of Olympic Agenda 2020 in terms of shaping the application as an invitation.
The so-called invitation phase.
That's right. And, in fact, it's a system that we've had within FIS, within international skiing, for around 10 years, where each of the candidates, they're submitting a questionnaire which is the same for all candidates, so you're rather consistent in terms of what you're asking from them, questioning and so on, and it's easy to be able to compare the information. But then we sit down together with the inspection group, we call it, instead of the evaluation group, and we go through their project, and we go through all of the questioning and the responses that they've given in order to try to build the best possible bid. Now, to come back also to a previous point about the fact that actually for World Championships you're looking here at organisers who are doing events time and time again. They're a regular part of your whole setup. So you know that what you're looking for in terms of using the championships as a platform to go to the next stage and to look at new opportunities. But anyway, we spend a lot of time to go through that, because the professionals who are within the inspection group are the persons who are going to be working with that elected organiser afterwards. So you really want to make sure that you've got the best possible project that you can achieve, and use really the expertise within the group as a more or less a consulting for trying to develop it and improve it.
Thanks, Sarah. Okay, maybe we can open this one to the audience now. Would anyone like to ask any questions? We've got one there in the third row at the end. It's just coming.
My name is Eric Anderson. I work for Arup Host City Advisory Services. I'd like to go back to the Agenda 2020 and Olympic Games for a little while. There is a cynical and highly simplistic view of Agenda 2020 that merely helps the mega cities of this world staging the Olympics by allowing them to move venues out to the suburbs, satellite cities, and so on. What specifically, in the panel's point of view, what specifically is it in the Agenda 2020 that would help the second-tier cities down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 million inhabitant cities to actually bid for and stage the Games?
Thank you. Excellent question. Who'd like to take that? Janesh, would you like to start with that?
Well, a difficult question. First of all, you know, at the beginning, everybody is for democracy and everybody would like to include small cities, but there is the final result is what it counts. The last decision was Beijing, what is not the smallest city in the world. And not even the city with the biggest skiing tradition. My opinion is that it is not only the dimension of the city which decides, but they are very often the so-called geostrategical elements which bring us to such decisions. If we are speaking about the changing world, you know, the biggest change in today's world is the emergence of the middle class in China, which will be pretty soon as large as the whole middle class in Europe. And to bring them to winter sports would be the biggest change and also the biggest favor to winter sports industry you can imagine. On the other side, if you ask me, if I directly answer your question, what are the elements which should help smaller cities? First, you know, the bidding process, where you discuss the concept with the city and adapt to the present infrastructure. Then the rule that it is not necessary that it is only the bid of one city, that there could be several cities, and there is even an exception allowed that some of the competition should be outside the country. You know, you remember the story of Quebec bid for the Winter Olympics. They do not have a mountain high enough for the downhill. They once elaborated a concept how to make the arrival under the level of sea, but that's all very artificial. Now they can easily resolve in St. Lawrence Bay. Now they can easily resolve the problem going somewhere to an existing downhill. So it will include smaller city, but I do not believe that a smaller city could be organizer of Summer Olympics. I believe that a smaller city could be an organizer of Winter Olympics under the condition that the events will be spread out in countries.
Thanks, Janesh. Anyone else like to? Yes, Brian.
Yeah, I think the Olympics is one thing, winter or summer, but let's not forget that all of us international federations have our World Championships, World Cups. These are equally valid, I think, for cities, host cities to have aspirations towards. And, you know, we are very, very happy to talk to people. You know, we all have different types of events as well. You know, if I talk just about cycling, we have our World Road Championships, we have track, we have mountain bike, BMX, cyclocross, we even have artistic cycling and trials and cycle ball, even things like that. So those are things that can be built into the infrastructure of any host town or city quite easily, really. So let's not just think about the one big event, the Olympic Games. Let's think about sport in a more holistic way.
Louise, then Sarah.
Can I just come in on that one as well? Because within the Federation, what we do is, as you all know, we've got the main games, and it's those cities that can host them. But what we're trying to do with them as well is try and encourage them if they've already got the facilities there, enhance those facilities, or if the other ones were in the planning, bring them forward to be able to do that. So we have cities who can host the main games, but then we're looking at cities who can't host the main games but could host youth games. And then from that, if you can host the youth games, then you go to the next tier down to host the general assemblies, and then the next tier down after that, it's the executive board, so that every country in the Commonwealth can have some area in which they can actually bid and host part of the Commonwealth Games Federation, and it does work.
Thanks, Louise. Sarah?
Following up from Jens's remark, I think for the Winter Games, the opportunities are even greater, actually, to be able to use regional games more or less also over the whole country and between different countries as well. And the earlier concept, which involved Slovenia, Austria and Italy, was within a regional area, more compact actually than several of the other bids. Then you also have very important winter nations who are doing all sorts of events where they're missing one certain sport, like the mountain. Quebec is one example. Finland is another very good example, who are doing winter sports in all different possible sports. They don't have a bobsleigh track, but there's one not too far away in Lillehammer, and certainly with travelling across and facilitating that, there's even discussion of a potential Scandinavian bid where there are great facilities across the different nations in Scandinavia. So I think this is part of those sort of roadmap discussions that will be carried out between the International Winter Sports Federations and the IOC, and certainly the federations are open-minded.
Thanks, Sarah. More questions. I think I saw another one, yes, up there in the middle, towards the back.
Thank you. Jason Ferguson from World Snooker and International Billiard Sports. My question is really to the whole panel. We're just coming back to the original agenda item of the Agenda 2020, and I know, Brian, you've been quite vocal about what sports should be in what Olympic Games. So I'm coming at it from that kind of angle. My question to the whole panel is, do you think Agenda 2020 has achieved what it was set out to achieve? And if not, what changes should we see going forward?
Right. Challenging question. Brian, go for it.
Well, if there would be the goal of Agenda 2020 to achieve something in a certain short period of time, we didn't achieve it, because the idea was to start the change. And I said, when I started to speak today, that the changes should be permanent, not only linked to the Agenda 2020, they should be built up later on. International sport needs changes, not only in those fields which are now at the top pages of international papers, like corruption, like doping, and some other scandals. It needs changes because we should adapt to the needs of the present youth, which is different than it was in previous times. We should adapt to the developing sport, to developing society, to developing international relations, and in general, I think that Agenda 2020 was the right step ahead, but certainly not a program which could be fulfilled in a short period of time.
Thanks, Janesh. Time's moving on, so we'll try and keep the answers fairly short. Brian, I think you had a point on that.
Not long after I was elected, about a couple of years ago, I got myself into a lot of trouble by suggesting, and Sarah's looking daggers at me already, I'm sure, that maybe some of the sports that take place indoors in the Summer Olympics could usefully be transferred into the Winter Olympics to get a better balance there. That's been comprehensively ruled out, I'm told, by Sarah and many others. But, you know, the point remains, and I wasn't the first person to suggest it, got me into a lot of trouble with no less a figure than Marius Weiser, which may or may not have been a good thing, as it's turned out. But the point's there, and let's see how things evolve. No doubt somebody else will suggest it in the future.
Thanks, Brian. Quick word, Sarah?
They probably will. The issue is, what do we do with indoor arenas in the Winter Games, basically? Snow and ice is really the philosophy of the Winter Games, so that they have their own identity and snow and so on. I think a key point of Olympic Agenda 2020 is that it's designed also to stimulate ongoing discussion, and that it's a continual work in progress. And we have to realise that we are living in an evolving society, and sport plays an important role in that. So it's talking about 2020, and that's down the road anyway, 5 years away. What will it have accomplished by then? Certainly a lot compared to where we were sitting 2 years ago when the discussions began. I believe that in any case, but I think we mustn't just get to 2020 and say, there we are, it's done now, and it should be a permanent revolving tool, actually, to keep refreshing what we're doing and addressing it and looking at it and making sure that we are really aligned with the developments in society.
Thanks, Sarah. Did we have a question over there?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, my name is Marion Meyer. I'm working for TDH. And I want to ask a question referring to an article that was published in a Danish sport magazine. It was called Sport Executive some months ago, with the title When Sport Falls in Love with Dictatorship. And the article refers to the fact that mega sporting events go to authoritarian regimes like Sochi, Baku, Russia, Qatar, Beijing as a trend. And so one question would be like about responsibilities. Like, what could, for example, the European, like the EOC or NOCs kind of step up, and for example, for the next attribution of after Baku, now Belarus is into the discussion for 2019. And so this would enforce this trend. So what is how to say the potential? What is the power of NOCs, EOCs, and also maybe international federations, and also like the association to say, wait a minute, let's check that first. Where are we going? Maybe about athletes, like what is the potential for that? And then the second point, as you've mentioned with Agenda 2020, some of these issues are now addressed, but what are the sanctions? What are the consequences? Who is checking if these things are implemented or not? And if they are not implemented, who is saying what's going to be the consequence of that?
Superb question. Janesh, can I come to you first? Yeah. Particularly if I could just ask you to focus on the attribution of the next European Games and what kind of scrutiny you undertake for the cities that are bidding.
First, we do not have bid process. So we are negotiating with one candidate, and we will tell to the public the name of the candidate when we vote about it next week at the General Assembly of European Olympic Committees in Prague. I can't tell you today this. It would be contrary to our rules. Second, very interesting question, human rights or dictatorship towards sport. First, sport didn't make the dictatorship and can't be responsible for the human rights issue. We are all coming from the countries which have, with all those countries you mentioned, diplomatic relations. They are members of United Nations. They are members of Council of Europe. Some of them even presiding some of the bodies which deal with human rights, and there are very many fields where our countries and our society can influence those countries and bring to public attention the question of human rights. Sport is not deteriorating human rights issue in the countries where we go. In the contrary, we open up those countries, we bring thousands of journalists to the countries, we very often open this question also with the authorities of those countries, but we do not have political responsibilities and we do not have the right to intervene in the matters which belong to sovereignty of those countries. So we can express our opinion. We always said that we wouldn't like to tolerate political activities in the frameworks of movement, but everybody in our organizations is free to express his opinion. People do it, and I think that wherever we were, in China, in Azerbaijan, the fact that we organized big events there was positive also for their approach and the development of their understanding of issue of human rights. Do we support dictatorship or not? We don't, but it is, again, a matter of individual personalities, countries, different approaches, and every nation has its system of elections and comes to the system of power as it comes. It's absolutely not right that Slovenia would maybe organize the system of power in China, or I would say even I couldn't understand that European countries would be able to do it.
Thanks, Janesh. I've been told we've only got 2 minutes left, so a quick word from each of the rest of the panel on that question. Brian?
Yeah, without being naive about it, I think sport is a power for good in these circumstances. If it brings people together in harmony, it's surely better than disputatious wars and all the other horrible things that we see happening in the world today. But equally, you know, we have to keep our eyes open and our ears open. But I think sport is a power for good in these circumstances.
Sarah.
A similar viewpoint, actually. The fact that these nations are willing to open up for the world to come and spend time there, for the media to be there, for the journalists, and to report from them, it's a platform in order to be able to perhaps help their development. It's certainly not a message from sport that regimes are tolerated in any shape or form, but nevertheless, what we're about are sport events, and if that is going to improve actually the situation in those countries, then sport has a positive role to play.
Thanks, Sarah. Louise.
I would agree wholeheartedly with that, and I think one of the good things within the Federation, in the Commonwealth Games Federation, is the fact that it's sport-led, and it's the sport organisation that actually goes to government and to the host cities to actually work together in partnership. And if that partnership stays true to itself, so far, touch wood, it has, I think it can only benefit everybody within that, the whole cycle.
Thank you, Louise. I think that's a great note to end on. I saw there were some other questions. I'm sorry we haven't got round to you, but I think it's our credit to our panel and the liveliness of the discussion that there weren't so many people wanting to ask them. So I'd like you to finish by thanking our panel. Thank you.